This week on the Allegheny Front, we're telling stories of the people behind the environmental news headlines. From the teenagers suing the state of Pennsylvania over climate change.
That's what made me start thinking about like the bigger picture beyond just like recycling and litter cleanup.
To a pioneering doctor who sounded the alarm about lead poisoning he saw in his patients.
We found that children who had high lead in their teeth, but who had never been identified as having any problems with lead, had lower IQ scores.
I'm Carol Holsapple. Those stories, plus a swimmer who knew his calling even as a kid.
I just wanted to always jump in the river, you know, and just kind of see what it was like.
That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We know climate change can be divisive. It splits people along political and economic lines. And sometimes those divisions can be very personal. That's what it was like for a young woman named Ashley Funk. When she was a teenager, climate change drove a wedge between Funk and her hometown in Westmoreland County's coal country. It's something she's still working out. From WBEZ Chicago's Heat of the Moment team, Shannon Heffernan brings us this story.
Ashley Funk grew up in southwest Pennsylvania, a small town called Mount Pleasant. And in Mount Pleasant, there are these huge man-made hills. They're big, sometimes two stories high. They're leftovers from nearby coal mines, and the companies dumped it in these big piles. Here's Ashley.
You kind of just see an expanse of black.
Ashley's family actually had one of these behind their house growing up. And she would go out there and play in it, build things in the piles, sort of like sandcastles. There's this really cute picture of Ashley from when she was around 7, and she's in her kitchen, and she's just covered in black dust.
So I had come in from outside, and we had this like white floor and it's all black. My mom talked about how she had to like mop it every single day because we'd run in and we would get the dust all over the ground. And I'm like so happy because I just came in from playing and there's just like this black stuff all over my face and all over my hands.
It was only when she was older, when she was in high school, that Ashley found out all that coal debris, the dust in those big piles, that stuff is really bad for your health.
I think my first reaction was like, I wonder what age I'm going to get cancer. It was just a lot of anger. All of those have been there for at least 100 years, and no one has done anything about it.
Lots of people around Ashley kind of took this in stride, but Ashley didn't. And to understand why she took it more seriously, you have to know the story of Ashley growing up. Ashley's interest in the environment started off small. She was in middle school, her family was poor, and she was already worrying about getting into college and affording it.
So when I was in eighth grade, I was watching like Gilmore Girls, and Rory is trying to get into Harvard, and Harris Geller tells her, like, you have to volunteer to get into college. And then that's whenever I realized, I was like, oh my God, I have to volunteer. I won't be able to get into college. So that's when I think that strangely started like my volunteerism.
Ashley got a bunch of other Mount Pleasant kids together to pick up trash on the side of the road.
We like started this like little organization and we called it Pollution Patrol. The motto was making a Mount more pleasant piece by piece.
People in the town donated bags, donated gloves. Everyone loved the Pollution Patrol. It was really charming. People would actually stop their cars to thank Ashley and all the kids. That next summer, Ashley went to this science camp. It was sponsored by NASA, and because her family was low income, it was all paid for. Every kid in the program had a different focus for what they would study.
My focus was on like environmental stuff because I was like, oh, this is related to like litter and stuff in the environment. And so I did like climate change research and I looked at different like energy efficiency technologies and different work that NASA was doing and monitoring. That's what made me start thinking about like the bigger picture beyond just like recycling and litter cleanup.
This was kind of the arc of Ashley as a teenager. Little by little, she got more and more interested in both science and the environment. And not just the environment, but specifically climate change. She was the child of a coal industry town who started going around talking about sustainability, carbon emissions, and the problems with energy companies. She became really passionate about the environment. A national environmental group called Our Children's Trust heard about Ashley and reached out. The group works with young people to participate in lawsuits over climate change. The idea is that children have a human right to a healthy environment when they're grown, And if we destroy that, we're violating that basic right. In 2012, Ashley became a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the state of Pennsylvania over its carbon emissions. If Ashley won, it would force the state to take action. The whole thing, obviously, very anti-coal.
So I didn't tell anyone that I was doing it. I just did it. I went downstairs and I was like, hey, mom, can you sign these papers for me? You have to sign them because I'm a minor, but I'm like filing this lawsuit. And then my mom was like, okay. And then, yeah, it was kind of weird.
At first, Ashley just kind of assumed that she could keep this whole court case thing quiet, you know, on the down low.
I mean, I knew that there would be a lot of people that didn't approve of it. Like, I didn't tell my dad for a while because I thought, like, because at that point he, like, very strongly did not believe in climate change.
If it isn't clear already how deeply in coal country Mount Pleasant is, consider that Ashley's neighborhood is called Standard Shaft, as in mining shaft. The neighborhood was literally built by a coal company. And now there's a lot of fracking operations going on. It's particularly hard for people there to imagine a world without fossil fuels. Then here she is, this kid from coal country, now the plaintiff in a suit against the state of Pennsylvania over climate change. The suit was filed in 2011. It was the beginning of a long trip through the court system. In the end, Ashley lost the suit, but it got the attention of coal companies, the state, and of course, the people in Mount Pleasant. Pretty soon, in the same town that used to stop and thank Ashley for picking up litter, those same people were calling her a hypocrite.
Someone was like, oh, she lives in Shaft. Like, how do you think her house was built?
Ashley says the stuff that actually hurt. People didn't say that stuff to her face. They said it online. When there were newspaper stories about the suit, comments would sprout up underneath them. People called them fools, idiots, worthless human beings. One person wrote, congratulations on eliminating over 500 jobs and putting yet another dent in the Southwest Pennsylvania economy. By this time, Ashley was getting ready to go to college, and she couldn't wait to get out. Partly she was just sick of being in a small town, but she also felt like she didn't belong here anymore.
So I like went through this really long process of trying to get rid of my accent. It just sounded very proper. Like, I didn't sound like I was like 17. My friends would always be like, Ashley, like, shut up. Stop being so smart. And then I would like just be like, haha, you're making fun of me. But in reality, they were like, Ashley, stop it. You're making an idiot of yourself.
Even though Ashley lost the lawsuit, she did get what she was after back when she first started getting involved with the environment. She got into a really prestigious school. Wellesley is where Hillary Clinton went.
I really needed like a change of pace. And at that point, I thought like I was going to leave Mount Pleasant and never come back.
Ashley's plan was to put some real distance between herself and where she was from. Go away to college, find people like herself, start a new chapter, join a new tribe. She got into Wellesley in the fall of 2012, declared her major, environmental studies, and turned the page. Ashley's outgoing, so making friends wasn't that hard. She joined other students for the Keystone Pipeline protests. During school breaks, she traveled for environmental field research. Only, after not too long, Ashley realized the closer she got to her adopted tribe, the less and less they felt like her people. Sure, they shared her interest in the environment, and they were largely lefty. But take this story she tells about a class she had her freshman year. It was called Wealth and Poverty.
Everyone would talk like they would just keep saying like they do this and they do that, or like this is how like people feel when they're on food stamps, completely like as if they're not in the room.
Because of course Ashley was in the room. Her family had been on food stamps. Things like this kept happening. It was so disappointing. This is where she was supposed to belong, but they totally didn't get her. And maybe, she started thinking, she identified with her hometown more than she thought. This semester, she's taking a class called Chemistry in Context. It's all about seeing environmental science play out in the real world. And fracking came up, which is a really personal issue for Ashley. Her mom had leased her land to Chevron for fracking, and Ashley knew it was a huge help to her mom, who was really struggling financially. All the other students were talking about how terrible fracking was. like how it could ruin the water supply, and man, those poor people. Ashley says it was like all of them had watched one too many environmental documentaries, but never actually been to a place like her hometown.
I didn't want to be in, like, be around these people that were, like, talking about my home. Like, it was this different place where people were victims. I wanted to, like, kind of, like, show that there was, like, power from the towns themselves. Yeah, I wanted to be around people that were like me and had that similar experience growing up.
After all that, after leaving Mount Pleasant for what she thought was for good, Ashley wants to go home. And it's the issues that drove her away to begin with that are making her want to return to Mount Pleasant. Because she feels like that's where there's work to be done, where there's a reckoning to be had over climate change. Not a place like Wellesley, where everyone's removed and for the most part agrees with each other. But instead, in a town where hills are made out of coal debris and people need fracking dollars just to get by. Where the conversations about this are messy, and that's the point. And so, nothing's certain, but Ashley's plan is to double back. She'll be able to pick up a lot of things where she left off, including her lawsuit. After the first one was tossed, there have been some revisions. They filed it again. And Ashley's a plaintiff this time, too. Shannon Heffernan, WBEZ.
Rebecca Hersher also contributed to that report. For more about WBEZ's Heat of the Moment, stories about everyday life on a changing planet, visit our website, AlleghenyFront.org.
I'm Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front. Pennsylvania has thousands of shale gas wells in it and lots of pipelines moving that gas around the state. How many are leaking methane, the very potent greenhouse gas? Scientists are trying to find out.
Just went up to 9 ppm.
Wow.
So this is a leaky pipeline right here.
Join me next week on the Allegheny Front for a look at new discoveries in the race to count the climate impacts of shale gas.
Pennsylvania's natural gas boom has reshaped the nation's energy landscape and sent billions of dollars into small towns. But the surge in drilling has also brought disruptions, like skyrocketing housing prices and an influx of new people to rural areas. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick paid a visit to Towanda in the northeastern part of the state. It's a place where people have had a bumpy ride as the town's drilling boom went bust.
Good afternoon, Grace Connection.
It's a busy afternoon at Grace Connection. It's a nonprofit run by churches that provides emergency assistance for people who need help.
Valerie? Yeah.
Judy Smith is fielding requests for things like shelter, transportation, and food. This is how she sums up the gas boom.
There's a lot of good and there was a lot of bad.
Not long ago, Towanda was a major hub of Pennsylvania's drilling industry. It meant a lot more jobs and money flowed into this rural area. But housing prices spiked, and some people were left out in the cold.
During the boom, it was a lot of people who could no longer pay the rent because the landlords started raising the rents. And we were trying to find them a place to live. However, a lot of folks, we just couldn't find a place for.
Smith says even some people who did well during the boom weren't expecting the drastic slowdown that came when gas prices plummeted and the rigs disappeared.
So now we're seeing people who had purchased a new car to get to work, no longer can make the payments. People who fixed their house up, got a loan to fix their house up, can't make the mortgage payment or the payment, the extra loan they took out.
Crystal Shagrin is one of the people in need of help.
Thank God places like Grace's Connection and other places that help us out, because if not, I'd probably be one of them people that are homeless, and I busted my butt for 10 years and I have nothing to show for it.
She moved up to Towanda a decade ago and used to have her own house. But after a divorce and an injury that prevents her from working, she's here trying to get assistance to pay her electric bill.
We didn't have oil for a month and we ran space heaters. Don't ever do it, because it ran my bill up to $400 for 1 month. I mean, that's crazy.
She sits down with a volunteer who looks over the bill.
Chagrin. Here her account numbers, 100.
Even though many of the gas workers are gone, Chagrin says rental prices are still a lot higher than they used to be.
It doesn't work when you have an income like ours, you know?
And the only place she can now afford is a trailer park.
So it just made our poverty go really low because they were making so much money and bringing it into the community, but now they're not even around anymore and they're still trying to get them kind of prices.
Grace Connection has been trying to tackle the problem of homelessness in town, but Judy Smith says they haven't been successful yet in getting a shelter for people who need a place to stay.
It's hard to describe, but the way we feel when we go home, you know, we can't help them and it's quite hard.
The oil and gas industry is known for its rapid swings. So if the economics change, things could always start booming again. It remains to be seen whether Towanda will be ready for the next bust. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
People have been using lead for thousands of years and have known it's poisonous. But it wasn't until the 1970s and the work of a doctor from Pennsylvania that we found out what we know today. Even small amounts of lead can cause long-term IQ deficits and learning disabilities in children. Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segura tells us the story of that doctor and why almost 40 years later, our problems with lead persist.
It's 1957. We're at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Dr. Herbert Needleman is on his way to see a 3-year-old patient. Needleman's a young doctor, 6 feet tall, with brown eyes and dark hair. This is the first case of lead poisoning he's ever seen, and when he shows up, the girl is not in good shape. Her eyelids are drooping, her pulse is slow, she's not making a sound.
This girl was lethargic and you know, almost comatose.
That's Lydia Denworth, who wrote a book about Needleman called Toxic Truth. Needleman has Alzheimer's disease and wasn't able to talk for this story. At the hospital, Needleman prescribes the girl medicine that gets rid of the lead in her blood. And over the next couple days, she starts to feel better. Needleman's feeling pretty good about himself.
He thought he had fixed her problem.
He talks to the mom and tells her, you know, your daughter's okay, but she was probably poisoned by lead paint or dust at your apartment, and you can't go back there.
And the mother just looked at him and said, well, where am I supposed to go? You know, she didn't have any money. She was a single mother. And suddenly, Needleman says it's like the scales fell from his eyes.
As a doctor, Needleman couldn't go home with his family and take the lead paint off their walls. This girl was probably going to end up back in the ER again. This patient marks the beginning of a lifelong crusade for Needleman. He goes on to make a huge discovery that changes the way we think about the dangers of lead. In the 1950s, when Needleman's a new doctor, lead is everywhere. Paint, pipes, toys, gasoline. You'd hear commercials like this one on the radio.
Drive up to the pump with the Ethel emblem and say, fill her up.
But Denworth says at this point, a lot of doctors aren't testing kids for lead because the symptoms of lead poisoning, like vomiting and seizures, look like other diseases. As an experiment, Needleman's hospital starts testing all kids for lead.
When they did, they began to see that it was far more widespread than anyone had ever thought.
After this, Needleman becomes consumed by thoughts of lead. This would be a good time to point out that everyone describes Needleman as a crusader against injustices, large and small. His son Josh tells a story about a canoe trip the family took when he was a kid. He and his father are paddling along a river, and they see a group of teenagers sitting around and smoking.
Generally, I think the kind of group that now as an adult I would try to avoid. And they were throwing rocks at a duck that was floating in the river.
Needleman gets really angry that they're trying to hurt this duck.
And he began to shout at them and said, leave that duck alone.
They're so shocked that they stop.
He could just not hold himself back when he saw something that was unjust.
Josh says the same thing went for lead. As Needleman sees all these kids come into the hospital with lead poisoning, he comes across a study from the 40s showing that children who'd been poisoned by lead later had behavioral problems and low IQ scores. And he starts to wonder, these children all had severe lead poisoning, but what about the smaller amounts of lead that most kids are exposed to every day? Could that be damaging their brains? He designs a study to find out. Lead builds up in the bones, so Needleman uses children's baby teeth to measure their lead exposure. He practices on Josh's teeth, which kind of rules out the tooth fairy. But that sort of myth would never have been a fixture in Needleman's home.
I can't imagine my father participating in a fiction in deliberately deceiving his children, even in fun. It's not the kind of person that he was.
After collecting the teeth, Needleman and another researcher test the kids to see if the ones who have high levels of lead also have these cognitive problems. Here he is describing the results in a PBS documentary years later.
We found that children who had high lead in their teeth, but who had never been identified as having any problems with lead, had lower IQ scores, poor language function, and poor attention.
The findings are controversial. Critics, including companies that make lead products, say these things can be caused by other factors, like family life and education. Denworth explains.
A kid in the inner city has all kinds of problems, right? They said the lead is one teeny piece of this, and the effect is minimal, even if there was any effect at all. And Needleman thought any effect at all was criminal.
The research has an impact. The Environmental Protection Agency has already started phasing lead out of gasoline, and in the 80s, thanks in part to Needleman's research, it speeds that up. There's also a federal ban on lead pipes. And then the government puts out a plan to eliminate lead poisoning for good. It says more children should be tested for lead, and that we need to get lead out of kids' homes so they're never poisoned in the first place. Needleman testifies in front of Congress in support of a bill that would fund those efforts.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Herbert Needleman.
His hair is gray now, and he's wearing wire-rimmed glasses and a beige suit.
There is a broad consensus on the part of everybody except the lead industry and its spokesman that lead is extremely toxic at extremely low doses.
He calls removing lead from gasoline a public health triumph, but he says there's more work to do. The idea of getting the lead out of homes, there's a lot of resistance to it from landlords and realtors who say it's too expensive. The bill and others like it don't pass Congress. In 1992, Congress does pass a law requiring landlords to disclose lead paint hazards to tenants, but it can be hard to enforce. In the meantime, Needleman's worried about something else. A couple scientists who represent the lead industry in lawsuits accuse him of scientific misconduct. They say he cherry-picked his data to prove a point. Here he is talking about that accusation in the PBS documentary.
If you're found guilty of scientific misconduct, you're out of business. Your reputation is ruined, you're through.
The University of Pittsburgh, where he's working, investigates for almost a year and finds no scientific misconduct. It says Needleman mischaracterized some of the procedures in his study, but not in a way that changes the findings. As time goes on, more and more studies show effects of lead at low levels, but government agencies stop talking about eliminating lead poisoning entirely. Some people say public health dollars are better spent on other problems, like obesity and diabetes. People make that argument today, too. Lead levels in young children have dropped by more than 90% since the late 70s, when Needleman did his first studies. But a lot of kids are still exposed to lead, through dust, old paint, and pipes. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says no amount of lead in the blood has been proven safe. Denworth says Needleman always felt like we hadn't done enough.
It became old news. We thought we'd solved the problem, and we never really were willing to finish it.
And that's why, despite all that's changed, kids still show up at the doctor with lead in their blood. And like Needleman back in the 50s, there's only so much that doctor can do. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Thanks to Keystone Crossroads for that story. They're a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. For more reporting on lead, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. finally, we're washing off some of today's heavier environmental stories and refreshing ourselves on the banks of Pittsburgh's rivers. It's a story from our series about the unique people that use the three rivers. In talking with these folks, there's one thing we've heard consistently. The rivers may be getting cleaner, but not clean enough for swimming. Apparently, no one told that to the marathon swimmer we're about to hear. He regularly takes to the water for 9 hours or more at a time.
My name is Darren Miller. I'm from Murraysville, Pennsylvania, and I enjoy swimming in the three rivers around Pittsburgh. I tell you what, I get interesting looks, I get interesting pictures taken of me. I've had the police called on me, the river rescue, saying that there's a distressed swimmer out in the waters, which I always got in the mindset of the passerby to say, what about me swimming parallel to shore, upstream, wearing a cap and goggles and a Speedo makes it look like I'm a distressed swimmer. So I think the perception of our city is that we have these three rivers, but you should never jump in them. You should only maybe ride a boat in them. Murky? I don't know. The water is, for the most part, clear. I really don't run into any garbage, you know? I think it's what a lot of people ask. But the reality is they are actually quite clean. I swim in them all the time, and it's an absolute blast. Basically, whenever I get started at night when I do a training swimmer in the morning, I'll pretty much just walk down to the dock wearing flip-flops and a t-shirt and a pair of shorts, disrobe, usually kind of hide my stuff as best I can here along the wall, and put a towel over top of it, hop in, swim, get out, dry off, and you look around, and then of course there's people looking at you, and you realize I'm in downtown Pittsburgh and basically a Speedo cap and goggles. You know, coming down to visit my aunt who lives here on the north side all the time, I'd always cross over the rivers. And I remember as a kid going over the bridges here and always looking down on the water and just thinking, you know, I just wanted to always jump in the river, you know, and just kind of see what it was like. And I never really did that growing up, now that I'm thinking about it. So one of the first times I remember jumping into the river really was I essentially jumped in with two powered boats and a group of kayakers. And we went for roughly about 9 hour swim. 3 hours in each of the rivers. I always tell people, because I get asked a lot, what do you think about, you know, this entire time that you're out there swimming for 9, 10, 12, 15, 18, 24 hours? And what I say is, one, when's the last time you sat alone and you just sit and you think about what you're doing and where you want to go with your life? You know what I mean? So it's like, there's like different, so many different forces working there. Probably the funniest thing is I have more clothes in my closet than my wife does, because I have what I like to call fat Darren, middle Darren, and skinny Darren, because most channel swimmers are bigger people. Think about it. You have to have that extra fat in order to overcome the cold. So I have anything from a giant suit, and now I have the thin suit, or I'm going from slim fit to, you know, big and tall store, you know. So that's the funny thing, is that people would look at these swimmers and think there's no way that person could do that. Meanwhile, they're out swimming 20, 30, 40 miles in the ocean, you know, just pushing themselves in ways that others wouldn't think is possible. One thing I always remember is a friend of mine who, he's out of Southern California, and he cracks me up because he says that the toughest athletes by far come from Pittsburgh. And I love that, you know what I mean? Because we get this perception of we are the steel town, we do have strength, and we have close family ties, and we're not afraid to push ourselves. And that's what endurance athletics is all about, and that's what swimming in these crazy rivers is all about. It's about pushing yourself and seeing what you're capable of.
That was marathon swimmer Darren Miller, and his story was produced by the Allegheny Front's Lou Bluen. There are more tales about Pittsburgh's rivers, diving in them, paddling, and even sailing on them. They're at AlleghenyFront.org/our-three-rivers. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Caroline Frederica Holdship Charitable Trust, the Park Foundation, and the Benedum Foundation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.